Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhib coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The leaked memo says the threat of a terror attack in Ghana is real, citing intelligence from the National Security Council Secretariat. It is addressed to Ghana's Immigration Service.
That's Francisca Cacra-Forson reporting from Accra. Details coming up.
Also, a UN official says up to 7,000 women and girls have been abducted in northeastern Nigeria in recent years, and about 6,000 migrants landed in Italy this week after crossing the Mediterranean from North Africa.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, West Africa has been on high alert following recent terror attacks on hotels in Mali, Burkina Faso, and Ivory Coast. Now there's a concern that Ghana and Togo are also targets. In Ghana, a leaked security document outlines the threat from an Al-Qaeda affiliate that claimed responsibility for the earlier attacks. However, Ghanaian President John Mahama has told the nation not to panic. Francisca Cacra-Forson reports from Accra.
The leaked memo says the threat of a terror attack in Ghana is real, citing intelligence from the National Security Council Secretariat. It is addressed to Ghana's Immigration Service. The document calls for stronger border surveillance, including thorough profiling of people from Mali, Niger, and Libya. The memo was shared on social media and picked up by local press. President John Mahama sought to reassure the nation on state-run radio Thursday.
We have trained our own special forces. Currently, we have a significant number on standby. We are preparing for any such eventuality, but we need the alertness of the public.
Ghana's government put the nation on high alert in March after Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb attacked a beach resort outside Abidjan, killing 19 people. The leaked document says information from Ivory Coast, including confessions obtained from the mastermind of the attack there, indicates that the attackers entered that country in a 4x4 vehicle registered in Niger. The memo says the attackers concealed their explosives and weapons in the spare tire compartment. Mahama said the leak was unfortunate.
You didn't need to put the intel in there, you just needed to send a directive asking for alertness and asking them to search more thoroughly vehicles and all that. Every country in West Africa is at risk, and we are at risk not only from external forces, but even from internal forces. We have evidence of radicalization of our own citizens, you know, who have gone out joining some of these terrorist groups.
The head of the West African Center for Counterterrorism in Accra, Mutharu Mukta Mumuni, says panic must be avoided.
We need to ensure vigilance to reporting of suspicious activity. However, we've got to be very careful in order not to condone acts that have a proclivity to lead to gross basic human rights violations, relating to lynching of innocent people.
The AKIM attacks in Burkina Faso and Ivory Coast marked an alarming expansion for the group, whose operations until then had been confined to North Africa and parts of the Sahel region. Francisca Cacra-Forson for VOA News, Accra.
A UN official says up to 7,000 women and girls have been abducted in northeastern Nigeria in recent years. Fatma Samura, humanitarian coordinator for Nigeria, spoke yesterday on the two-year anniversary of the kidnapping of more than 200 schoolgirls from the town of Chibok. She said the fate of those girls and many others remain unknown. While the Chibok incident has received more attention, about 300 children also were abducted from the town of Damasak in November 2014. They too remain missing. Boko Haram militants are using more abducted girls as suicide bombers in northeastern Nigeria.
Also, Yahayas, in northeastern Nigeria, more than a million displaced persons are now returning home. They're working to rebuild communities that were destroyed by the seven-year insurgency of Boko Haram. Former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo says it will be a long process, but in some areas, improvements are already underway. The reign of terror of Boko Haram has killed and displaced thousands, including 276 young schoolgirls kidnapped from their dormitories in the town of Chibok 2 years ago. Authorities are still trying to locate them. However, progress is being made. In recent years, the Nigerian military has dislodged Boko Haram from many of its strongholds, and former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo says he sees hope for the region after his recent visit to the capital of the northeastern state of Borno.
About 2 weeks ago, I was in Maiduguri, which is the, if you like, the epicenter of Boko Haram, just to see for myself what exactly is going on. I think compared with what I saw when I went there in 2011, there is a marked improvement. That city is taking a new shape, a new life.
President Obasanjo explains some of the signs of recovery he witnessed in Maiduguri.
When I was there in 2011, from the airport, you will know that you are in a war zone. That is not the case today. And the governor proudly told me that we are now rehabilitating internally displaced persons. His ambition is that by the end of this year, there will be no internally displaced person in any camp. The military people briefed me that the morale of the soldiers is very high and they are really moving.
Obasanjo emphasizes that while the military appears to have retaken territory from Boko Haram, work still remains if the region is to regain peace and stability. He says, for example, that support is needed for the areas most vulnerable, like women and children. He says once the military has secured a particular area, the state government encourages women to return home and rebuild their lives.
The governor has decided the women will have their livestock. They will supply them with livestock, goats and sheep. Fortunately, there are no landmines in the fields. So schools will be opened, health centers and clinics will be opened. From what I heard and saw, both from the ordinary people, from the military and from the state administration, I am happy that we're about to end the light beyond the tunnel.
However, Mr. Obasanjo says a long-term effort will be required to rebuild infrastructure, including health and other social services. He says, for example, that it takes 10 years for investments in education to yield results. Nigeria's former president urges the international community to help guarantee a secure and stable future for Nigeria's shattered northeastern region. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
About 6,000 migrants landed in Italy this week after crossing the Mediterranean from North Africa. Nevertheless, AFP reports that Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi is now downplaying the number of new arrivals. He says Italy is not facing an invasion. Mr. Renzi says the figures are similar to last year. However, some observers estimate as many as 250,000 migrants will arrive in Italy by the end of the year. That would be about 100,000 more than 2015. Italian officials are concerned that neighboring countries will close their borders and prevent migrants and refugees from traveling elsewhere. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Angela Merkel and other EU officials are scheduled to visit the Turkish border with Syria later this month. The visit follows last month's agreement with Turkey to stem the flow of migrants and refugees into Greece.
Coming up on 15 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The European Union is considering sending security personnel to Libya if requested to do so by the UN-backed Government of National Accord. Reuters reports the idea stems from the steady flow of migrants from Libya. EU foreign and defense ministers are expected to meet Monday in Luxembourg to discuss holding police and border security training sessions in Tripoli. EU ministers are also expected to consider special naval patrols on the Mediterranean to target human smuggling operations.
In Libya, a UN-brokered unity government hangs in the balance as two rival governments and armed militias decide if it's time to stop fighting. Tripoli appears to have accepted the presence of Fayez al-Sarraj and his presidential council, but the head of a parliament in distant Tobruk this week bridled at the rule of the UN envoy. The House of Representatives in Tobruk votes Monday on the new Government of National Accord. Two close observers disagree on the outcome of that vote. VOA's David Arnold has the story.
The unity government, crafted by two UN envoys over a year ago, seems to be making a go of it in Tripoli. That's where one of two rival factions have been trying to rule. The local Tripoli faction appears to have accepted the role of a lesser-known technocrat named Fayez al-Sarraj and his new presidential council of the Government of National Accord. The bigger question is what the House of Representatives in faraway Tobruk will do. That's the group long identified as the so-called internationally recognized Libyan government. They fled from Tripoli during intense fighting more than a year ago. Juma al-Gamati is a Syrian political activist in London and a leader of a party that joined in the UN negotiations for many months. Does al-Gamati think the lawmakers in Tobruk will approve political unification?
Yes, I do. I think there is a lot of pressure on them. Internally, the Libyan people want this government because they know that this government can unite Libya again and can tackle the urgent challenges of lack of security and the dire, harsh socioeconomic conditions. And also, this government can unite Libya again to fight the threat of terrorism in terms of ISIL, which does exist in Libya.
Karim Mizran is a fellow at the Atlantic Council's Rafiq Hariri Center for the Middle East in Washington, D.C. He specializes in the study of North African politics. Mizran is not so sure the Tobruk faction will vote for unity. He says there is great pressure on the exiled lawmakers, and some of it comes from a general who took his first military command under the rule of Muammar Gaddafi, who was overthrown in 2011.
General Khalifa Haftar is the formerly the head of the Libyan army. It's simply a coalition of militias fighting in the east, in the town of Benghazi, against the Islamists. He is a strong man in the east, and he has a lot of influence with the president of the House of Representatives, Aguila Saleh. So through him and some of his supporters, he's trying to prevent the holding of a meeting of the House of Representatives in order to reach the quorum to vote on the government of national agreement.
If General Haftar succeeds and the Tobruk House of Representatives, or HOR, rejects unity or does not even vote, Mizran says that won't mean the end of Libyan hopes for unity.
Well, most probably not. Most probably what the UN will do will go ahead with the simple acceptance of the political dialogue members and bypass entirely the problem of the HOR. I hope we won't get to that point.
Mizran and al-Gamati agree that prospects of a success in Tripoli do not hang in the balance of a vote in Tobruk, and both men entertain optimistic thoughts about the future of Libya under a new government headed by Fayez al-Sarraj. Al-Gamati even sounds excited.
So far, so good. This government of national accord was expected to face a lot of resistance, even military resistance, if it entered Tripoli. But the opposite has happened. It was welcomed. There was no resistance. And those so-called militias, the main organized military groups, have not actually taken any position against the government. They welcomed it because they themselves feel that they can no longer carry on fighting each other and dragging the country into ruins.
When the presidential council arrived in Libya, they arrived by boat at a naval base on the shores of Tripoli. Al-Sarraj surprised capital city residents by ignoring security risks and entering the city to meet with opposition leaders to set up his cabinet. Mizran describes al-Sarraj as a consensus maker, returning to his hometown constituency.
He is an engineer who has been elected in the HOR for the district of Tripoli. He comes from a very old and well-respected family. He is not a bully or a very strong character, but he's a mediator and has a personality that is good for this moment in Libya, I think, because we need somebody capable of reconciling and reuniting the country. And I think he's perfectly capable of doing that if he gets the full support of the United Nations and the international community.
Some of that support has come in airstrikes flown by U.S. and European aircraft attacking Islamic State forces that now hold the city of Sirte in the east. U.S. intelligence reports indicate that the number of terrorists has recently doubled to an estimate of 6,000 in the country. The new unity government will have a major fight on their hands. This is David Arnold for VOA in Washington.
Most of the world's population lives in cities, but income among those residents can vary greatly, spanning from poor to rich. Economic inequality in the world's cities was the topic of a recent conference in New York City, where mayors, philanthropists, NGOs, and business leaders from around the world gathered to kick off the first Inclusive Growth in Cities campaign. It was sponsored by the Ford Foundation and the Paris-based Office of Economic Development and Cooperation. VOA's Adam Phillips attended the conference and has this report.
In his welcome speech, Ford Foundation President Darren Walker told the group he believes inequality is one of the greatest threats of our time.
We know the trends that drive inequality, the lack of access to government decision making, rules of the economy that in fact magnify unequal opportunities, and the failure to invest in public goods, in public infrastructure. In every instance, the work you all in this room are doing to promote inclusiveness disrupts these drivers.
Keynote speaker New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio took the opportunity to tout his city's own proposal for inclusive growth. Nearly one in two New Yorkers live near or below the poverty line, according to a 2014 Center for Economic Opportunity report. It's been one of de Blasio's major legislative achievements to require that affordable housing be part of any luxury developer's proposed plans.
And they put a series of other plans in place, free education and after-school opportunities, a variety of actions that would lift economic burdens from the poor.
The 40% of New York residents who are born abroad include many immigrants who lack the necessary visas and legal documents they need to enter the social and economic mainstream. That's why de Blasio's administration created a program to give city-issued identification cards to all comers, regardless of legal status.
It allowed people to do things they couldn't do previously. 500,000 people who couldn't get a bank account, who couldn't sign a lease for an apartment, who couldn't go visit their child's school because they didn't have an ID that was recognized. And what it has meant is that people who felt left out, people who felt they were in the shadows, people who felt no form of government actually embraced and acknowledged them, now feel they belong more, not enough, but more, and that they can do so much more in the society and they can take care of their families better simply because there was something that gave them that connection and that validation.
Skills building for urban migrants is also a top priority for Mayor Johnson Munyanya of Mukono Municipality near Kampala, Uganda. Mukono's population has nearly quadrupled since 2002 to nearly 175,000 people. Most newcomers are unskilled young men from the countryside who want to work in the capital's growing industrial sector. When these men either fail to get hired or lose their job due to factory closures or other factors, they often return to his town, idle and demoralized.
They don't go back. They stay. And you get a lot of challenges.
That can mean crime, from petty theft to drug dealing, and a sense of hopelessness that can lead to radicalization. To address both inequality and crime, many advocate an educational path for youth that includes high school and university. Muyanya says Uganda has 30 universities, but adds that book knowledge alone is not marketable in today's changing economy.
So that's why now we are changing, and emphasis is put on practical industrial skill development, which doesn't need years to stay in school. For example, 6 months, you train someone on mechanical training, carpentry, so that they can go out and work.
Issachar Nuhu Hupuatia, mayor of Wa Municipal Assembly in Ghana's Upper West Region, has worked hard to ensure that girls are educated alongside boys and can become equal partners in the workforce. This has sometimes meant a learning curve for Wa's citizens, the majority of whom are traditional Muslims.
And Muslim background means that women should not lead. Women should not venture into other enterprises in the public. But because of the improvement in the educational level, more and more people now have access to formal education. And those that get educated are used as role models to turn around the perception of people, be it men or women. And it's getting better.
Mayor Noho Putia also says improved access to clean water also allows children to spend more time in school and women to have full-time paying jobs. Participants in the Inclusive Growth for Cities campaign agree that in addition to education and infrastructure, access to markets, communications, and political transparency must also be urgently addressed for full inclusivity and equality to be realized. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
A major operation is getting underway today to move thousands of Mozambican asylum seekers in Malawi away from the dangerous border area to a secure camp further inland. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UNHCR, which is running this operation, plans to relocate some 10,000 Mozambican asylum seekers to a former refugee camp in southeast Malawi, about 320 kilometers away from the volatile border area. The camp, which is being reopened for this purpose, previously housed many of the more than 1 million refugees who fled Mozambique's long-running civil war between 1977 and 1992. Mozambicans have been fleeing to Malawi since December of last year because of renewed sporadic fighting between the opposition RENAMO and government forces, peaking at more than 250 people a day in early March. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler tells VOA the situation appears to be stabilizing now, but the border area remains unsafe.
We need to see how it evolves, and in the meantime, we have to move people away from an area where they could be potentially at risk. Also, it will be easier for us to provide assistance to them further inland. I mean, some of these areas are very remote. During the rainy season, the roads are basically impassable, and that's another reason why we are moving them.
A first group of 81 Mozambicans left in Sanje district on two buses early Friday morning. The UN Refugee Agency says they will stay at a transit camp for up to 2 days on arrival. After being transferred to the camp at Luani, it says they will be provided with a plot of land, food, shelter materials, and household items. It says the majority of the Mozambican asylum seekers live in overcrowded conditions in the village of Kapise, an area about 100 kilometers south of the capital, Lilongwe. It says the relocations from Kapise and other villages along the border to Luani will soon begin. The UNHCR says the relocation process will be conducted in a phased manner and should be completed in 6 to 8 weeks. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyi Suhuib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. And on behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
This is Peter Clawton, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.